Chapter 1. Putting It Mildly. If the intended reader of this book should want to go beyond disagreement with its author, and try to identify the sins and deformities that animated him to write it, and I have certainly noticed that those who publicly affirm charity and compassion and forgiveness are often inclined to take this course, then he or she will not just be quarrelling with the unknowable and ineffable creator who, presumably, opted to make me this way. They will be defiling the memory of a good, sincere, simple woman, of stable and decent faith, named Mrs. Jean Watts. It was Mrs. Watts's task, when I was a boy of about 9, and attending a school on the edge of Dartmoor, in southwestern England, to instruct me in lessons about nature, and also about scripture. She would take me and my fellows on walks, in an especially lovely part of my beautiful country of birth, and teach us to tell the different birds, trees, and plants from one another. The amazing variety to be found in a hedgerow, the wonder of a clutch of eggs found in an intricate nest, the way that if the nettles stung your legs, we had to wear shorts, there would be a soothing dock leaf planted near to hand. All this has stayed in my mind, just like the gamekeeper's museum, where the local peasantry would display the corpses of rats, weasels, and other vermin and predators, presumably supplied by some less kindly deity. If you read John Clare's imperishable rural poems, you will catch the music of what I mean to convey. At later lessons, we would be given a printed slip of paper entitled Search the Scriptures, which was sent to the school by whatever national authority supervised the teaching of religion. This, along with daily prayer services, was compulsory and enforced by the state. The slip would contain a single verse from the Old or the New Testament, and the assignment was to look up the verse and then to tell the class or the teacher, orally or in writing, what the story and the moral was. I used to love this exercise, and even to excel at it, so that, like Bertie Wooster, I frequently passed top in scripture class. It was my first introduction to practical and textual criticism. I would read all the chapters that led up to the verse, and all the ones that followed it, to be sure that I'd got the point of the original clue. I can still do this, greatly to the annoyance of some of my enemies, and I still have respect for those whose style is sometimes dismissed as merely Talmudic, or Quranic, or fundamentalist. This is good and necessary mental and literary training. However, there came a day when poor dear Mrs. Watts overreached herself. Seeking ambitiously to fuse her two roles as nature instructor and Bible teacher, she said, "So you see, children, how powerful and generous God is. He's made all the trees and grass to be green, which is exactly the colour that's most restful to our eyes. Imagine if instead the vegetation was all purple or orange, how awful that would be. And now behold what this pious old trout hath wrought." I liked Mrs. Watts. She was an affectionate and childless widow, who had a friendly old sheepdog who really was named Rover, and she would invite us for sweets and treats, after hours, to her slightly ramshackle old house near the railway line. If Satan chose her to tempt me into error, he was much more inventive than the subtle serpent in the Garden of Eden. She never raised her voice or offered violence, which couldn't be said for all my teachers, and in general was one of those people, of the sort whose memorial is in Middlemarch, of whom it may be said that if things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been, this is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life, and rest in unvisited tombs. However, I was frankly appalled by what she said. My little ankle-strap sandals curled with embarrassment for her. At the age of 9, I had not even a conception of the argument from design, or of Darwinian evolution as its rival, or of the relationship between photosynthesis and chlorophyll. The secrets of the genome were as hidden from me as they were at that time to everyone else. I had not then visited scenes of nature where almost everything was hideously indifferent or hostile to human life, if not life itself. I simply knew, almost as if I had privileged access to a higher authority, that my teacher had managed to get everything wrong in just 2 sentences. The eyes were adjusted to nature, and not the other way about. I must not pretend to remember everything perfectly or in order after this epiphany, but in a fairly short time I had also begun to notice other oddities. Why, if God was the creator of all things, were we supposed to praise him so incessantly for doing what came to him naturally? This seemed servile, apart from anything else. If Jesus could heal a blind person he happened to meet, then why not heal blindness? What was so wonderful about his casting out devils, so that the devils would enter a herd of pigs instead? That seemed sinister, more like black magic. with all this continual prayer, why no result? Why did I have to keep saying, in public, that I was a miserable sinner? Why was the subject of sex considered so toxic? These faltering and childish objections are, I've since discovered, extremely commonplace, partly because no religion can meet them with any satisfactory answer. But another, larger one, also presented itself. I say presented itself rather than occurred to me, because these objections are, as well as insuperable, inescapable. The headmaster, who led the daily services and prayers, and held the book, and was a bit of a sadist and a closeted homosexual, and whom I have long since forgiven because he ignited my interest in history and lent me my first copy of P.G. Woodhouse, was giving a no-nonsense talk to some of us one evening. "You may not see the point of all this faith now," he said, "but you will one day when you start to lose loved ones." Again, I experienced a stab of sheer indignation as well as disbelief. Why, that would be as much as saying that religion might not be true, but never mind that, since it can be relied upon for comfort. How contemptible. I was then nearing 13 and becoming quite the insufferable little intellectual. I had never heard of Sigmund Freud, though he would have been very useful to me in understanding the headmaster, but I had just been given a glimpse of his essay, The Future of an Illusion. I am inflicting all this upon you because I am not one of those whose chance at a wholesome belief was destroyed by child abuse or brutish indoctrination. I know that millions of human beings have had to endure these things, and I do not think that religions can or should be absolved from imposing such miseries. In the very recent past, we have seen the Church of Rome befouled by its complicity with the unpardonable sin of child rape, or, as it might be phrased in Latin form, no child's behind left. But other non-religious organizations have committed similar crimes, or even worse ones. There still remain four irreducible objections to religious faith. That it wholly misrepresents the origins of man and the cosmos, that because of this original error, it manages to combine the maximum of servility with the maximum of solipsism, that it is both the result and the cause of dangerous sexual repression, and that it is ultimately grounded on wish-thinking. I do not think it is arrogant of me to claim that I had already discovered these four objections, as well as noticed the more vulgar and obvious fact that religion is used by those in temporal charge to invest themselves with authority, before my boyish voice had broken. I am morally certain that millions of other people came to very similar conclusions in very much the same way, and I have since met such people in hundreds of places and in dozens of different countries. Many of them never believed, and many of them abandoned faith after a difficult struggle. Some of them had blinding moments of unconviction that were every bit as instantaneous, though perhaps less epileptic and apocalyptic, and later more rationally and more morally justified, than Saul of Tarsus on the Damascene Road. And here is the point about myself and my co-thinkers. Our belief is not a belief. Our principles are not a faith. We do not rely solely upon science and reason, because these are necessary rather than sufficient factors, but we distrust anything that contradicts science or outrages reason. We may differ on many things, but what we respect is free inquiry, open-mindedness, and the pursuit of ideas for their own sake. We do not hold our convictions dogmatically. The disagreement between Professor Stephen Jay Gould and Professor Richard Dawkins concerning punctuated evolution and the unfilled gaps in post-Darwinian theory is quite wide, as well as quite deep. But we shall resolve it by evidence and reasoning and not by mutual excommunication. My own annoyance at Professors Dawkins and Daniel Dennett for their cringe-making proposal that atheists should conceitedly nominate themselves to be called brights is a part of a continuous argument. We are not immune to the lure of wonder and mystery and awe. We have music and art and literature, and find that the serious ethical dilemmas are better handled by Shakespeare and Tolstoy and Schiller and Dostoevsky and George Eliot than in the mythical morality tales of the holy books. Literature, not scripture, sustains the mind and, since there is no other metaphor, also the soul. We do not believe in heaven or hell, yet no statistic will ever find that without these blandishments and threats we commit more crimes of greed or violence than the faithful. In fact, if a proper statistical inquiry could ever be made, I'm sure the evidence would be the other way. We are reconciled to living only once, except through our children, for whom we are perfectly happy to notice that we must make way and room. We speculate that it is at least possible that once people accepted the fact of their short and struggling lives, they might behave better toward each other and not worse. We believe with certainty that an ethical life can be lived without religion, And we know for a fact that the corollary holds true, that religion has caused innumerable people not just to conduct themselves no better than others, but to award themselves permission to behave in ways that would make a brothel keeper or an ethnic cleanser raise an eyebrow. Most important of all, perhaps, we infidels do not need any machinery of reinforcement. We are those who Blaise Pascal took into account when he wrote to the one who says, "I am so made that I cannot believe." In the village of Montaillou, during one of the great medieval persecutions, a woman was asked by the inquisitors to tell them from whom she had acquired her heretical doubts about hell and resurrection. She must have known that she stood in terrible danger of a lingering death administered by the pious, but she responded that she took them from nobody, and had evolved them all by herself. Often you hear the believers praise the simplicity of their flock, but not in the case of this unforced and conscientious sanity and lucidity, which has been stamped out and burned out, in the cases of more humans than we shall ever be able to name. There is no need for us to gather every day, or every 7 days, or on any high and auspicious day, to proclaim our rectitude or to grovel and wallow in our unworthiness. We atheists do not require any priests, or any hierarchy above them, to police our doctrine. Sacrifices and ceremonies are abhorrent to us, as are relics and the worship of any images or objects, even including objects in the form of one of man's most useful innovations, the bound book. To us, no spot on earth is or could be holier than another. To the ostentatious absurdity of the pilgrimage, or the plain horror of killing civilians in the name of some sacred wall or cave or shrine or rock, we can counterpose a leisurely or urgent walk from one side of the library or the gallery to another, or to lunch with an agreeable friend in pursuit of truth or beauty. Some of these excursions to the bookshelf or the lunch or the gallery will obviously, if they are serious, bring us into contact with belief and believers, from the great devotional painters and composers to the works of Augustine, Aquinas, Maimonides, and Newman. These mighty scholars may have written many evil things or many foolish things, and been laughably ignorant of the germ theory of disease or the place of the terrestrial globe in the solar system, let alone the universe. And this is the plain reason why there are no more of them today and why there will be no more of them tomorrow. Religion spoke its last intelligible or noble or inspiring words a long time ago. Either that or it mutated into an admirable but nebulous humanism, as did, say, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a brave Lutheran pastor hanged by the Nazis for his refusal to collude with them. We shall have no more prophets or sages from the ancient quarter, which is why the devotions of today are only the echoing repetitions of yesterday, sometimes ratcheted up to screaming point so as to ward off the terrible emptiness. While some religious apology is magnificent in its limited way, one might cite Pascal, and some of it is dreary and absurd, here one cannot avoid naming C.S. Lewis, both styles have something in common, namely the appalling load of strain that they have to bear. How much effort it takes to affirm the incredible. The Aztecs had to tear open a human chest cavity every day, just to make sure that the sun would rise. Monotheists are supposed to pester their deity more times than that, perhaps lest he be deaf. How much vanity must be concealed, not too effectively at that, in order to pretend that one is the personal object of a divine plan? How much self-respect must be sacrificed, in order that one may squirm continually in an awareness of one's own sin? How many needless assumptions must be made, and how much contortion is required, to receive every new insight of science, and then manipulate it so as to fit with the revealed words of ancient man-made deities? How many saints and miracles and councils and conclaves are required, in order first to be able to establish a dogma, and then, after infinite pain and loss and absurdity and cruelty, to be forced to rescind one of those dogmas? God did not create man in his own image. Evidently it was the other way about, which is the painless explanation for the profusion of gods and religions, and the fratricide both between and among faiths that we see all about us, and that has so retarded the development of civilization. Past and present religious atrocities have occurred not because we are evil, but because it is a fact of nature that the human species is biologically only partly rational. Evolution has meant that our prefrontal lobes are too small, our adrenal glands are too big, and our reproductive organs apparently designed by committee, a recipe which, alone or in combination, is very certain to lead to some unhappiness and disorder. But still, what a difference when one lays aside the strenuous believers and takes up the no less arduous work of a Darwin, say, or a Hawking or a Crick. These men are more enlightening when they are wrong, or when they display their inevitable biases, than any falsely modest person of faith, who is vainly trying to square the circle and to explain how he, a mere creature of the Creator, can possibly know what that Creator intends. Not all can be agreed on matters of aesthetics, but we secular humanists and atheists and agnostics do not wish to deprive humanity of its wonders or consolations. Not in the least. If you will devote a little time to studying the staggering photographs taken by the Hubble telescope, you will be scrutinizing things that are far more awesome and mysterious and beautiful, and more chaotic and overwhelming and forbidding, than any creation or end-of-days story. If you read Hawking on the event horizon, that theoretical lip of the black hole over which one could in theory plunge and see the past and the future, except that one would regrettably, and by definition, not have enough time, I shall be surprised if you can still go on gaping at Moses and his unimpressive burning bush. If you examine the beauty and symmetry of the double helix, and then go on to have your own genome sequence fully analyzed, you will be at once impressed that such a near-perfect phenomenon is at the core of your being, and reassured, I hope, that you have so much in common with other tribes of the human species, race having gone, along with creation, into the ash can, and further fascinated to learn how much you are a part of the animal kingdom as well. Now at last you can be properly humble in the face of your maker, which turns out not to be a who, but a process of mutation with rather more random elements than our vanity might wish. This is more than enough mystery and marvel for any mammal to be getting along with. The most educated person in the world now has to admit, I shall not say confess, that he or she knows less and less, but at least knows less and less about more and more. As for consolation, since religious people so often insist that faith answers this supposed need, I shall simply say that those who offer false consolation are false friends. In any case, the critics of religion do not simply deny that it has a pain-killing effect. Instead, they warn against the placebo and the bottle of coloured water. Probably the most popular misquotation of modern times, certainly the most popular in this argument, is the assertion that Marx dismissed religion as the opium of the people. On the contrary, this son of a rabbinical line took belief very seriously and wrote, in his contribution to the critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, as follows. Religious distress is at the same time the expression of real distress and the protest against real distress. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, just as it is the spirit of a spiritless situation. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is required for their real happiness. The demand to give up the illusions about its condition is the demand to give up a condition that needs illusions. The criticism of religion is therefore in embryo the criticism of the veil of woe, the halo of which is religion. Criticism has plucked the imaginary flowers from the chain, not so that man will wear the chain without any fantasy or consolation, but so that he will shake off the chain and cull the living flower. So, the famous misquotation is not so much a misquotation, but rather a very crude attempt to misrepresent the philosophical case against religion. Those who have believed what the priests and rabbis and imams tell them about what the unbelievers think, and about how they think, will find further such surprises as we go along. They will perhaps come to distrust what they are told, or not to take it on faith, which is the problem to begin with. Marx and Freud, it has to be conceded, were not doctors or exact scientists. It's better to think of them as great, infallible, imaginative essayists. When the intellectual universe alters, in other words, I don't feel arrogant enough to exempt myself from self-criticism. And I am content to think that some contradictions will remain contradictory. Some problems will never be resolved by the mammalian equipment of the human cerebral cortex, and some things are indefinitely unknowable. If the universe was found to be finite or infinite, either discovery would be equally stupefying and impenetrable to me. And though I have met many people much wiser and more clever than myself, I know of nobody who could be wise or intelligent enough to say differently. Thus, the mildest criticism of religion is also the most radical and the most devastating one. Religion is man-made. Even the men who made it cannot agree on what their prophets or redeemers or gurus actually said or did. Still less can they hope to tell us the meaning of later discoveries and developments which were, when they began, either obstructed by their religions or denounced by them. And yet, the believers still claim to know. Not just to know, but to know everything. not just to know that God exists and that he created and supervised the whole enterprise, but also to know what he demands of us, from our diet to our observances to our sexual morality. In other words, in a vast and complicated discussion where we know more and more about less and less, yet can still hope for some enlightenment as we proceed, one faction, itself composed of mutually warring factions, has the sheer arrogance to tell us that we already have all the essential information we need. Such stupidity, combined with such pride, should be enough on its own to exclude belief from the debate. The person who is certain and who claims divine warrant for his certainty belongs now to the infancy of our species. It may be a long farewell, but it has begun and, like all farewells, should not be protracted. I trust that if you met me, you would not necessarily know that this was my view. I have probably sat up later and longer with religious friends than with any other kind. These friends often irritate me by saying that I am a seeker, which I am not, or not in the way they think. If I went back to Devon, where Mrs. Watts has her unvisited tomb, I would surely find myself sitting quietly at the back of some old Celtic or Saxon church. Philip Larkin's lovely poem, Church Going, is the perfect capture of my own attitude. I once wrote a book about George Orwell, who might have been my hero if I had heroes, and was upset by his callousness about the burning of churches in Catalonia in 1936. Sophocles showed well before the rise of monotheism that Antigone spoke for humanity in her revulsion against desecration. I leave it to the faithful to burn each other's churches and mosques and synagogues, which they can always be relied upon to do. When I go to the mosque, I take off my shoes. When I go to the synagogue, I cover my head. I once even observed the etiquette of an ashram in India, though this was a trial to me. My parents did not try to impose any religion. I was probably fortunate in having a father who had not especially loved his strict Baptist Calvinist upbringing, and a mother who preferred assimilation, partly for my sake, to the Judaism of her forebears. I now know enough about all religions to know that I would always be an infidel at all times and in all places, but my particular atheism is a Protestant atheism. It is with the splendid liturgy of the King James Bible and the Cranmer Prayer Book, liturgy that the fatuous Church of England has cheaply discarded, that I first disagreed. When my father died and was buried in a chapel overlooking Portsmouth, the same chapel in which General Eisenhower had prayed for success the night before D-Day in 1944, I gave the address from the pulpit and selected as my text a verse from the Epistle of Saul of Tarsus, later to be claimed as St. Paul, to the Philippians, chapter 4, verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, and if there be any praise, think on these things. I chose this because of its haunting and elusive character, which will be with me at the last hour, and for its essentially secular injunction, and because it shone out from the wasteland of rant and complaint and nonsense and bullying which surrounds it. The argument with faith is the foundation and origin of all arguments, because it is the beginning, but not the end, of all arguments about philosophy, science, history, and human nature. It is also the beginning, but by no means the end, of all disputes about the good life and the just city. Religious faith is, precisely because we are still evolving creatures, ineradicable. It will never die out, or at least not until we get over our fear of death, and of the dark, and of the unknown, and of each other. For this reason, I would not prohibit it, even if I thought I could. Very generous of me, you may say. But will the religious grant me the same indulgence, I ask, because there is a very real and serious difference between me and my religious friends, and the real and serious friends are sufficiently honest to admit it. I would be quite content to go to their children's bar mitzvahs, to marvel at their Gothic cathedrals, to respect their belief that the Quran was dictated, though exclusively in Arabic, to an illiterate merchant, or to interest myself in Wicca and Hindu and Jain consolations. And as it happens, I will continue to do this without insisting on the polite reciprocal condition, which is that they in turn leave me alone. But this religion is ultimately incapable of doing. As I write these words, and as you read them, people of faith are in their different ways planning your and my destruction, and the destruction of all the hard-won human attainments that I have touched upon. Religion poisons everything.